Good evening and welcome to this week's episode of Atlantic Tales, when we'll hear from actor, poet and musician Davo Grin from Milltown Malbay. Davo Grin was born into a house and life of music. Planxty worked on their first album in the basement of the Rin family home in County Kildare. As a child, Davo saw many visitors to the house, including Andy Irvine, Donal Lunny, Paul Brady and Matt Malloy, as well as his uncles Christy and Barry Moore. Davo's own career has been varied. He worked as a stagehand, editor and lighting engineer before settling down as a stage manager. He worked as a roadie on tours with Tina Turner, Phil Collins, Michael Jackson, Pavarotti and many other great artists. Now based in France with his family, Davo eventually returned to his musical roots and has been busy writing and recording. Before moving to Milltown Malbay with his family as a boy, it was in Kildare he was raised.
I was born in 1968 in County Kildare, in Downing's House, County Kildare and Prosperous, the son of Anne and Davo Grin. And yeah, we lived in Kildare then until 1977 and moved to Clare in 1977. And I was raised in Clare then up until about 1988, 89 when I moved then to London. Growing up in Kildare, we used to live in a big, huge Georgian house, which served half as a house and half as an antique store. My father used to store all of his furniture in the living room and in the study room area. He had a bit of a farm going on, taken over from my grandfather's work when he was fit enough to be doing it. And music. That would be the big memory that you'd have from Prosperous, Downing's House and Prosperous would be music. It would be Planxty recording their album when I was about 3 or 4 years of age in the basement of the house. One of their first albums was recorded there. And just the 70s and the crack, like, you know, coming back from the pub and waking up the kids and the music would be starting and all of that. You know, this was the way it was back in those days. And it was a very rich childhood, really.
You're talking about Christy Moore,
Christy Donal, Matt Malloy. The whole lot of them would have passed through the house. The whole lot of them would have passed through the house back in the day. They would have been all young fellas back then as well, of course, wouldn't they?
And so, you remember this vividly.
I have a great memory for childhood. Wouldn't be able to tell you what happened yesterday. But I can remember stuff from my childhood. Yeah, it's amazing, all right. I do. I remember particularly Lee Moog tuning up his pipes and the dreadful noise he used to make. It used to be, and it'd go on for ages because, you know, pipes. So yeah, I do remember that, yeah. And I would have been very, you know, Planxty, and then later Moving Hearts, it would have been a big thing in our house. We would have been at all the gigs every time any of the family played, particularly when we moved to Clare. We would have been dragged along to the gigs, to the festivals. Listening to Varna would have been a yearly visit for us. And then, of course, moving to Milltown Malbay, and then plunging into, because Prosperous would have been the folk scene, of course, with Andy and Donal and Liam. But then Milltown Malbay would have been the traditional scene, so I would have started to play the tin whistle, the bowron, singing songs and getting into the traditional music, yeah. It was fantastic.
What do you remember then of being told, lads, we're moving to County Clare?
Oh, that's a good question, Pat, to be honest with you, because I wasn't a happy bunny at all, I can assure you. It meant leaving all my friends. I really wasn't happy about it, and I probably was the only one who was not happy about it because I'm the eldest, and I would have had friends, and it would have affected me. And then, of course, you're coming to Clare, and you're a blow-in, and you have that little bit of a thing going on as well. So it wouldn't have been easy, you know, it wouldn't have been easy. Of course, my parents had the great idea to move on the 16th of December, 1977, in the middle of a big storm. It was unreal, the whole thing really was. But sure, listen, we settled in and we're still here now.
The move was memorable because...
The move was huge. It was quite dramatic. I mean, dramatic. Leaving Downing's house was dramatic. My brother Turlock got his hand caught in the door when the door was being closed. So going down the avenue, we used to live in an avenue, leaving the avenue, and everyone, the whole car was screaming, crying, especially Turlock because he got his hand caught in the door, the poor man. And it was drama, yeah. It was drama. Moving was drama. And then, you know, I used to go up to Kildare and stay. My grandmother lived in Newbridge at the time. So I'd go up there and spend Easter holidays.
You were always drawn back.
Always drawn back to see my friends and yeah, yeah.
And settling in then here in Milltown Malbay and going to school, a new school, and making new friends.
All of that, yeah. And listen, Looking back at it now, it was wonderful. It really was. My parents put us into a school. We didn't get put into the Milltown School, where everyone went to it, and a national school, which was out by the crosses of Anna, and it was a struggling country school, very small school. And it was really interesting, because I would have come from a big school in Prosperous, and two teachers only in that school dealing with six different classes, like, you know. So that was a different job back then, wasn't it, really? And that one of those teachers, Tessie Welch was her name, from Mullock, and she used to teach me the whistle as well. She was one of my first tin whistle teachers. She was a tough woman. And then my parents put me into the tech in Milltown Malvey. My father wanted me to continue on with the furniture trade.
I get the impression you had no interest in that.
It was a good dream, but it didn't quite go his way. But listen, but what saved me really in the whole thing was football. Football, I got in with the football, with the lads of football. I was an okay football player, and that got me in with the lads, so I was no longer a blow-in, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I changed the accent quite rapidly as well. The Kildare accent left me quite fast when I came to Clare. But that's just the way of it, like, you know, it's...
Did you like school? Had you any interest in school?
Oh, wow, gosh. School, you know, but school was so different back then. I mean, even the tech in Milltown, it was... Teachers were hard. They were hard, you know, you could get a box, and that would be normal. There was one fella in there, without mention any names, obviously, but there was one teacher in the school, and the odd drink would be had, like, you know, you'd see him sucking the old bottle of vodka during the break and stuff like that. Smoking in the class was quite normal. Different times, like, you know. Did I like school? What I did like about school was the music, was the drama. And I got in with, there was a teacher, Sean P. Minogue, who was the headmaster of the tech, and he loved drama. So I got in with the Drama Society. Harry Hughes then, when I moved to the convent in Spanish Point, Harry Hughes had a great, because the tech closed down, and the tech, this convent took on the students of the tech. And Harry Hughes then took me on as a debate in debates. There was a debating society, and then there was a theatre society. Sister Goretti was in the musicals. And so there's a whole kind of an area of the arts that had opened up to me through school, I suppose. And I took from school what I wanted for myself, I suppose, or what I enjoyed myself. And that was the arts, theatre, music and football.
The whistle, was that because Dad played it?
As well. Yes, it was, and the bow run. The whistle. Davok would have started to teach me the whistle when I was about six. He would have taught me how to play the scale when I was about six, and then when we moved down here, first there was Tessie Welch, then there was Breed O'Donoghue here. She would have taught me the whistle, and then once I had a couple of tunes, so you learn yourself, don't you know? And the bow run came a little bit later. Christy gave me my first bow run when I was about 10, and I've always played the bow run with the hand. I've never touched a stick. And I probably am one of the very few bow run players that only plays with the hand. It's unfortunately a style of bow run playing that's pretty much gone now, you know. The stick has really taken over. Of course, there's no commerciality in the else in just playing with your hands, so I can see how the stick might master that. But it's a pity, because the hand playing is a very unique and particular style of playing the drum, and yeah. So I keep flying that flag.
Another one down in London town, breaking stone, breaking bones, having the crack with the ex Paddy still on the railway. So swing them hammers, boys, make them sing. Swing them hammers, boys, make them ring. Swing them hammers, boys, till you can't swing them no more.
Age of 16, I believe you took off, packed your bags.
Yeah, a couple of incidents happened. A couple of things happened at the age of 16. August weekend was a horrific weekend for the family. I lost my best friend in a motorcycle accident, and my father lost his best friend. That was on a Friday, and my father lost his best friend in a boating accident on the Sunday. And that would have sent me into a bit of an old spiral, like, you know. I was shocked, and I was also, school was becoming a bit of an issue. I was repeating fourth year because I enjoyed fourth year so much, because it was just a DAS year, of course, don't you know? But it wasn't a good idea, and I was getting into trouble, basically. I was getting into trouble. I was starting to rebel, and I was, and my mother just kind of got to a stage where she just said, listen, I have a friend in London. Why don't you go over to her for a while and do some work, get some work? And that's what I did.
And decided that you should go to England.
Yeah.
How did you react to that? Was it something, as a young fella, you said, my God, I'll take on the challenge?
Oh God, I was dying to get out. To be honest with you, I was dying to get out. And it was great. Oh, the opening of a new world to me. I lived in Brixton. the Brixton community at that time was Irish and Jamaican. And, you know, for a fella from West Clare who'd never really seen a coloured person before in their lives, you're all of a sudden plunged into this world of music, of the street festivals and street music, and just wonderful. I know, I had a great time in London. I grew up in London, and I grew up fairly fast. I was walking on the building sites and walking with a few lads from Milltown here, and in a safe place as well. The woman who looked after me very well, a woman called Claire Keating, an English lady who now lives up in Belfast, and she had a young son at the time called Joe. It was a great thing for my mother to do, and it set me on a new path really, and got me out of Milltown. And I came back to Ireland then probably about 2 years later, and I moved to Dublin, and I started doing the Gaiety School of Acting. I decided that I wanted to become an actor, and then I went into acting.
Had you brought music to London with you, or had you packed it in at that stage?
No, I hadn't. You see, it's funny the way the whole music thing went. I always had a guitar with me, but I never really... No, I didn't. I didn't. It's only the last 10 years that music has really come out of me comfortably and easily and in public and all of that, yeah.
So when you came back, you went into theatre. What was the draw there?
Again, through my experience in the convent with Harry Hughes and with Sean P, and I really enjoyed the whole acting thing. I loved the taking on of roles and acting things out and wearing costumes and all of that whole thing. So that's what would have really inspired me to do that. And I always loved writing and poetry and reading, and I was always a big fan of that. So it kind of fitted into the way I was at that time, bohemian and all of that kind of thing, you know. So did a year in the Gaiety School of Acting and worked as a professional actor for 2 years, 2.5 years. I worked with the Gaiety, with the Borstal Boy. I was in the Borstal Boy, and then I was in the Abbey for 4 different shows, all small parts, of course. Got to tour Hong Kong with the Abbey, Playboy the Western World, Barry Lynch playing the Playboy. A lot of those old actors now have passed on. That was 2 or 3 years, and then Ireland in the late 80s was kind of, unemployment was huge. And the acting jobs were becoming fewer and fewer, and I was doing street trading. I was walking on the street selling jewellery and scarves and hats and scarves during the World Cup, the 1990 World Cup. And that's when I made a bit of money. And with that bit of money, I headed off to Germany. And that was me gone out of Ireland for the second time. And that was 1989.
So that was because of the lack of work here?
Yeah, there was nothing happening. There was just nothing happening. And I was getting bored. And I met a lovely German lass. And sure, what else would you be doing but following over back to Germany? Well, then I moved to Berlin. And I lived in Berlin for about 2 or 3 years, just after the wall came down. And Berlin was a party, because the wall, the reunification of Germany and the wall coming down was such a huge thing in Germany at the time. We mightn't have felt it over here in Ireland, but it really was a huge thing. And it was party time. Everyone, families were seeing each other. They hadn't seen each other for 40 years. And there was just a whole great time in Germany. And I went back into theatre, but not as an actor, as a stage technician.
Behind the scenes?
Behind the scenes. And that's what I did for 25, 30 years. I worked as a stage manager in different theatres and different festivals, and I'm still doing it to this day. I still have one festival a year, the Jazz of Vienne. I've been working on that festival since 2003. So it went backstage.
You went on the road. You were
on the road.
A roadie, as they say.
I was a roadie. I did roadie for Michael Jackson, for Prince, for Aerosmith, there was so many of them. And people always are amazed by that, but you actually don't get to meet the artists, you know. You're setting up before they even arrive onto the place, and by the time they've arrived there, it's in gig mode and you're put over into the corner, or you could be follow spot. And I did a follow spot for a couple of years as well.
On the lighting,
yeah. So yeah, I did all of that. That was great.
Was there always a case, Devogue, that you wanted to try something different, or did it just happen that way?
Just kind of happened that way. You know, when I moved to Germany, of course, I didn't speak any German at the time, so I couldn't have gone into acting in Germany unless it was with an Irish association or an English speaking association or anything like that. And I suppose when you go abroad and when you live abroad, you just bounce with whatever opportunities come to you. And that was one of the opportunities that came to me. Pink Floyd were actually doing a gig in Berlin in the early 90s, no, late 80s. And I was there and I was watching the whole thing being set up, and I was thinking, God, I'd love to do that. And I got talking to one of them because I saw where they were going for a drink afterwards, the crew. And I got onto the crew of doing the get out for that big concert that they did on the wall. So I dismantled the whole thing with that crew, and that gave me an in with the crew, and that meant that I got further work from them.
A lot of travel involved?
A lot of travelling all my life.
Did you enjoy the travelling, or do you enjoy
it? I do enjoy the travelling. I enjoyed it more, I think, now than I would have back then, because the transport has changed and it's much better. European train travel is fantastic. It's very good. France is not that expensive, but you can get deals. You get used to travelling, you know.
In London, huge Irish community. Was there much of an Irish community in Germany?
Irish pubs. You'll find it even today, but certainly back then, Irish pubs were run by Irish people in Germany. There was proper Irish pubs. This day and age, in Germany, there's still quite a few Irish fellas over there, Irish couples over there, just running Irish pubs. Much more so than in France. France, all the Irish pubs are fake Irish pubs. Like, you know, they're just little businesses with an Irish tag on them. Like, you know, I don't like them. Don't like them at all. Don't like the whole plastic paddy vibe over in Europe at all. It's quite tacky, especially around St. Patrick's. You know, as a musician, it's awful. It's awful as an Irish musician over in Europe, because you get put into this category of the drinking wild rover. Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the nay-nevers. People get insulted if you refuse to sing the song. I had people walking out because I refused to sing the Wild Rover. I said, no, I don't sing that song. It's a tourist song. I'm not interested. And they get offended and they walk out. Or you get the kind of thing, the Irish man is here. Come on, we'll have some drink. And I don't drink anymore. I stopped drinking 17 years ago when my girls were born. And what would be the reaction to that? First would be disappointment, because they're not going to have a party with the Irishman that they thought they would. They won't be able to take the selfie with the drunken Irishman. And the second thing is, they say, oh, you're not a real Irishman, so. Which, ha 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 ha.
Yeah.
But when that happens every second time, it becomes a bit less ha ha ha. And we have to realise that we've been sold down that road of that image of the drunken Irish. The whole alcohol marketing has made us look like that's all we are. So your first conversation that you'll have with a European, insofar as Ireland is concerned, would be about Guinness or whiskey. And then it might go to music, which it often does, thankfully. You see, we have that, and that's a very strong part of our identity. But unfortunately, like, over the years, I've refused categorically to play for St. Patrick's. I'd just not do it, refuse to do it.
Take the day off.
Take the day off.
Does it happen a lot, and in different countries, or are other countries stereotyping us more than others?
It's a laden question. I'll put it to you like this. I was in Germany for the first time this year in Germany for St. Patrick's. The difference between, for example, the Germans and the French or the Spanish would be language. The Germans speak English, French don't. So when the Germans come here, they can converse with the Irish people. They can read the Irish history books. They know stuff. The French tend to only be able to interpret, for one thing. And then the other thing, it's only tourist books they're reading. And so you know the tourist books, what they're saying. They're only selling the cliche things, aren't they? Go to this, go to that, drink the Guinness, all of that kind of stuff. So, yeah, as a musician, again, it's a hard one. It's a tough one, because it's not only one day in France or in Germany either. It's the whole month. It's the whole bloody month of March is taken up with saying bloody Patrick. Like, you know, it drives me mad. So I tend to kind of make fun of St. Patrick and talk about St. Bridget, you know.
So they've commercialised St. Patrick like Christmas, many would
claim.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. Oh, my God, it's so bad. I mean, it's so bad. I'll tell you what it isn't, and what it is at home, is it's a community thing, and the parades are for children, where over in Europe, it's for adults who want to get drunk. That's really it. It's all about the sales. It's all about selling drink. That's the way it is. I just try to avoid it as much as possible, but you make good money on St. Patrick as well.
Can't turn that down.
It's hard to turn that down.
You have to make a living.
So you got to make a living. So you just put the head down. And I've found especially since COVID, I've said, okay, go. Here we go, St. Patrick. I'll do it, right, yeah. But they're offering you good money. So you just put the head down, you do it.
Work is work. Absolutely. You mentioned France. You're based in France.
I'm based in France, yes.
Family's in France.
Yeah.
How did France come about?
I'll tell you now. Germany kind of started to fade. I wanted to come back home to Ireland in 2008. It was the Celtic Tiger years, and it seemed that Ireland was getting successful again and there might be work back in Ireland. So I came back to Ireland in 2008 to give it a go. And I was working with various different theatre companies and taking various different theatre companies around Ireland on tour. And I saw how Ireland had changed since I'd left it. And I couldn't really settle back in, to be honest. I found it very difficult to settle back in. The whole money mad thing that was going on at that time, and people buying property left, right and centre. It just felt all of very kind of strange. And basically I was in Ireland for about 2 years and I met a lovely French woman. So that was me gone again, basically. Following women all around the place. But this one held on to me.
Sorted you out.
She did, Sean. Oh, she did. Sophie is her name. Sophie Bouillot-Rin now. We got married in 2004. Our daughters were born in 2007. We have twin girls. They're 17 years of age now. And we're 20 years married this year. And we've been together for 24 years. God, the time just flies, doesn't it? Unbelievable.
Coming up, we'll be back in Milltown Malbay with Davo Grin to hear about how he returned to his musical roots after many years on the road.
Off with the grain, sailing out on the tide, feeding the master, our hunger they hide. Every field is a grave now, no place for a home. Nothing to stay, far away we must roam.
Welcome back to Atlantic Tales. Today we're in Milltown Malbay with actor, poet and musician Davo Grin. Originally from Prosperous in County Kildare, Davo's family moved to Clare in 1977. His father, Davok, a renowned whistle player, worked as an antique dealer, while Davok's mother, Anne, is a singer-songwriter and sister of Christy Moore and Luca Bloom. He was just 9 when he arrived in Clare, but packed his bags for London at the age of 16. Davok came back to Ireland and worked for many years on stage, backstage and then on the road before settling down in France and returning to his musical roots.
Yeah, I did. What happened to me was in 2008, my girls were born in 2007, and in 2008 I had an injury in my back and I was put out of work basically for about 7 or 8 months. I hurt my back and I stayed at home looking after my girls. My wife went back to work early and I stayed looking after my girls. And that's when I started to reach for the guitar and for the bowron and for the whistle. And I wasn't happy anymore walking backstage. I was getting frustrated with it. And the injury compounded that frustration and made me to start to think, okay, a plan B. And the music just seemed to be a natural kind of a way to go about it. And it just kind of happened by itself, you know. All of a sudden I started saying, okay, I created an association, an Irish Celt we called it, and I used to get people from Ireland to come out and do gigs. I wouldn't play myself, I didn't really have the courage as yet, but because when I had brought Irish people out, I'd feel more comfortable. And my mother, had brought my mother out, I brought Tim Dennehy out, brought Noreen Lynch out, you know, and we'd do little weekends, Irish weekends, singing weekends and stuff like that. And then I just started to go out there and do it myself as well. And loved it, and I haven't looked back since, I really haven't, and loving every minute of it, yeah.
You moved to France in 2001.
Yeah.
What was the plan work-wise? What were you doing at that time?
At the time, I'd maintained certain contacts with a company in London that I used to work for as a stage manager, and they used to have European operations with Renault, with Ford, with car people. And I used to do what they'd have with it. They'd have every once a year or twice a year, they'd have all of their car salespeople from Europe come to one venue and learn how to sell the new car. And this would be the thing. And I'd stage manage that. It was a well-paid job. So I'd do 2 or 3 of those jobs a year. And then my wife worked in a theatre and they started to take me on as well, because I had the backstage skills, I just didn't have the language. And that's how I learned the language, was working in the theatre. I was lucky, very, very lucky now, in fairness. A non-speaking French person usually wouldn't get a job working backstage. But because, one, I knew the route, the ropes, and two, my wife, of course, got my foot in there a bit better. And as well, of course, then I spoke a bit of German, because I lived in Germany, and they had a lot of German companies coming over, so that was quite handy. And then I picked up the French. And then, so a lot of my work then became not only technical but translation. Then about 2014, I got offered this part in an Irish dance show called Irish Celtic, which was touring France. And they were looking for, and I remember at this stage I did speak French, it's 2014, so I spoke French with quite a strong accent, which suited the part, because the part I was playing was the owner of a pub, the Irish Celtic pub. So it's a river dance kind of a setup. There's Shannos dancing in it from a fella down the road, in fact. Dermot Mead played my son, and he's a Shannos dancer from Coura Clare. And it was through Senan I got this gig. He called me up and said, they're looking for somebody over in France to play this part of this Paddy Flynn fellow who runs this Irish pub. Would you be interested? So I did the interview, came to meet the director and the producer. They kind of said, yeah, okay, let's do this. There was okay money in it. It was a long tour though. It was 6 weeks on the road. You're in a tour bus. You're traveling from one part of the country to the other. What it did though for me was it gave me courage to go out on stage a lot more. I was always, the nerves were always getting to me. Every time I'd sing in front of an audience, my voice would squeeze up and it would come out a bit screechy. And I had very fierce nerves, but when you're playing for 6 weeks every night of the feckin' week in front of 400, 500, 600 people as part of a big show, so the light, spotlight is not on you, but you're saying your thing and then you're going off and then it's all dance. You're going out, you're saying your thing. So it's a simple enough affair, but it gave me great courage. And that's when, that it was a big moment for me. That was when I was like, ah, I can do this. And then I started to write songs and I started to create a theatre character that I have. His name is Gangani. That's another story, Gangani, the creation of Gangani, which is a very interesting story. Gangani came about when I was looking at old maps of Ireland and I was thinking, what's the very first ever map of Ireland? The very first map ever recorded of Ireland was in the 3rd century, and it was a Greek fellow called Ptolemy. And Ptolemy, the cute fecker, went all around the coast of Europe just mapping out things and marking, there's a river here, there's a mountain here, there's a tribe, this tribe is here, that tribe is here. So when he comes to Ireland now, and you look at this map, Ptolemy's map of Ireland, have a look at it when you go home.
A blob.
It's a blob. It's just a blob, right? Because of course the skills wouldn't have been that great. But anyway, and this blob of Ireland, over where Wexford and Waterford usually would be Brigantes, the Brigantes tribe, which is kind of, yeah, okay, we've heard of that. But over Kerry and Clare, Gangani. Never heard of it in my life before, but I like the name. The kind of name struck me. I was like, oh, that's an interesting one. So I created this street theatre personage, if you like, this street theatre character called Gangani, who's an old druid, and he wears all of these mad hats. I mean, you might have seen some of the photographs, and he's got a scar going through his eye, and he's all this. And there's poetry comes in, the Bowron comes into it a lot. But Gangani, looking into it again, there was a tribe Gangani in Wales as well, in northern Wales. What's all this Gangani stuff?
Google, of course. You go into Google,
and there's in India, there's a Gangani mountain, there's a Gangani peninsula. So a whole kind of Gangani thing opened up, and that's why I created that character. And then I wrote a couple of songs and brought out my first album in 2018, Talk To Me. Brought out my second album in 2019. And third album is just coming out now in this spring. I still haven't really chosen a name for it. I think it's going to be called Are We Doing Well? And it's all songs that I wrote myself. Over the past five or 6 years, I've written quite a few poems and a couple of songs. And then I had a dry spell for about a year. Just didn't write a thing. Wasn't happening for me. Didn't want to force it. It'll happen when it happens. And September just gone, the last year. Just all of a sudden, big spurt of writing happened, and I wrote something like in a week, I wrote maybe 20 different pieces. I met this fella near where I live in the Beaujolais region in France. Met this fella called JP, who's a Norwegian lad who just moved over to Mackle, near where I live, from Dublin. He'd lived in Dublin for the last 24 years. Gosh, that's interesting. And he was building a studio. So I said, that's another interesting thing, yes. A little studio. And I'm like, the bells are starting to ring. And I go, ooh, interesting. So we got together and we created together my latest album, which I'm looking forward to.
At one time, across the continents and through the eras, the Gangani tribe wandered, carrying not just their tents, but a treasury of skills and wisdom. From crafting celestial melodies to weaving the very fabric of existence, their legacy echoed through time. Their nomadic spirits danced amidst the stars, navigating destiny through astrology and crafting instruments that spoke the language of the soul.
your music then, Davog, how would you describe it to someone?
It's funny, isn't it, that you see, the music business has categorised everything. Talking to you now, right here and now, I have no problem whatsoever saying that it's definitely influenced by folk music, definitely influenced by Irish. I wouldn't be saying that to a journalist over in Europe, because then I'd be put into that, again, that earlier conversation I was having, where you'd be put into that cliche bracket. So I've actually taken out the Irish word of all of my, in all of my posters and my advertisement. How would I describe my music? It comes from the heart. That's really, it's my self-expression. It's how I express myself. It's poetry, it's messages. I hate injustice. I absolutely abhor injustice. And for years I've been part of this group in France for the homeless. My granduncle died homeless in London in the 50s. My grandmother used to always tell us about this story of going to London to get the body and how difficult it was, and somehow that story always stuck with me. And since then, and I think a lot of the family members, I know Christy does as well, and I know Barry does as well, whenever we go abroad or whatever, that we look out for homeless people. You just automatically do, like, you know. So anyway, long story short, I used to go on these when I lived in the city. I used to go on these kind of soup runs where you go out every weekend on a Friday or Saturday night with a van and a load of soup and bread and stuff for the homeless people to eat and blankets and whatnot. And I'd bring my guitar with me and I'd just sing songs for them and play a few songs and that kind of a thing. So I wrote a few songs about the homeless. That's one injustice thing that I hate. I've brought out a single recently about the awfulness of war. Two songs about the awfulness of war. One is about the Ukrainian war, but they're personal stories to me. The Ukrainian war song is about a woman I know who lives in the Ukraine, Tatiana. The song is called Tatiana. She's a really good friend of mine, and she's going through just really, well, obviously we know, it's awful. It's absolutely horrendous. The Four Backer Boys is a story of these four Gaza boys playing football on a beach, and they were blown up by the Israeli warships in 2014, all from the same family, 9, 10, 12 and 13 years of age. And the reason that that is a personal story for me is because I was working with Musicians Without Borders in the Calais camps, in the refugee camps in northern France, back in 2014 when this incident took place. And I was in a tent teaching children how to play the guitar. This was one of the things that we used to do. And you just try, as a musician, you try to do whatever you can to help these poor people out. So while I was giving these kids this guitar lessons, I heard this wailing and screaming and roaring coming from another tent, maybe 3 or 4 yards down the road. And these women coming out and they pulling at their hair, and I was like, oh God, what's happened there? Like, you know, I mean, refugees camps are a very, very tense places, one way or the other. But this was bringing it to another level. So everyone, of course, was rushing out to see if what was going on, if anyone needed help. And it turned out anyway that these people who were going through this highly emotive state were neighbours of these young boys. They were Palestinians who were trying to get to England, and they were in the camp for the last 5 or 6 weeks, and they just heard that on the telephone or whatever. Word came through, and yeah. So, you know, and again, injustice, I fucking hate injustice, and I'll do anything to stand up for people who are trodden on, like, you know. So my music is very much part of that.
On a sunny day by the beach they played, four young backer boys in the sun's made, football and hide and seek, laughter and joy, not knowing their fate, not knowing the ploy.
Is your poetry inspired similarly?
Yes and no. A lot of my poetry is... I get very inspired by old poetry. The druid kind of stuff. Like, you know, the Gangani character is very much the poet in me. My own poetry tends to... Well, some of them become songs. I like to think of them as healing poetry. I wrote a poem there not so long ago, and I was going to change to make it into a song, but then I was like, no, it's a poem, leave it as a poem, as a spoken piece. And it's a poem called Whispers in the Air, and it's about grieving. It helped me grieve the death of a friend, basically. It was a poem that I wrote upon hearing of the death of a friend. And I know from reposting it on Facebook and stuff like that, anytime I see a friend who's lost somebody, I post that poem, and it always gets a very good reaction. So yeah, so that's
Job done for me.
Coming up, we'll hear more from Davo Grin and what the future holds for the actor, poet and musician.
Got nothing but the holes in me shoes. I ain't got nothing but these homeless blues. I ain't got nothing but the birds and the bees. Ain't nothing for sure. I got me well.
Welcome back to Atlantic Tales. Davo Grin is originally from Prosperous in County Kildare, but his family moved to Milltown Malbay in Clare when he was 9 years old. In Kildare, he grew up in a house full of music, where regular visitors included Andy Irvine, Donal Lunny, Paul Brady and Matt Malloy, as well as Davog's uncles Christy and Barry Moore. Christy bought Davog his first Bowron, just one of the many instruments he still plays today. He once saw Pink Floyd play in Berlin and got the bug for being a roadie and spent a few years touring with Tina Turner, Phil Collins, Michael Jackson, Pavarotti and many other great artists. After 25 years of working behind the scenes in the world of entertainment, Davo returned to his musical roots. Now based in France with his wife and twin daughters, when he's not writing or performing, he has another passion.
I love the blues. I love singing old songs from back. There's one song, for example, I sing, and I usually finish my set with it. And it's actually a rock band that used to sing it back in the 90s. Metallica, heavy metal and rock band. Nothing Else Matters. You know the song, of course.
Very good.
And I give it a folk kind of an element. So I just sing it in a very kind of a folk song kind of a way. And people really react to that. I love to sing it. I love old songs like St. James's Infirmary, House in New Orleans. I have a couple of old blues songs that I sing myself. Nirvana song, My Girl, My Girl. You know, for me, because some of the self-written stuff can be a bit heavy. Some of the themes can be a bit heavy, so it lightens it up. So it gives me something to create a balance with, like, you know, the tin whistle playing does that as well. I also play a jaw harp.
The doing away,
absolutely. I'll give you a little example of it later on, before you go. The doing, I discovered that instrument during COVID. I had one in the drawer for years and years and years, just sitting there, and I was like, never really paid it any attention. The one day during COVID, you know, the way you'd be cleaning out stuff that you need to be cleaning out because you're at home all the time. And so I pick up the jaw harp, or the mouth harp, and giving it a twang, 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 as you say. I said, gosh, that's an interesting instrument. And then I looked up on YouTube and I see how it really is played and how to play it properly, and discovered how it's played properly. So that's 4 or 5 years ago now, and I have about 30 of them at home from all different parts of the world, and it's a fascinating instrument. It's the great, 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 great grandfather of the accordion, of the concertina. If you open up a concertina, you swear you're looking at a load of jaw harps in a circle. So they all come from the same. It's the idea of because you have two bridges, and then you have a tongue in the middle, and it's air that passes that vibrates the tongue that creates the note. You with me?
Yeah.
So it's air that passes. The jaw harp just happens to be through the mouth, like the harmonica. It's the same thing. It's the same kind of.
And how do you vary the notes? Family. Moving it.
Moving your tongue, moving all your right. closing. There's those ways of moving your tongue from all the way back to the front. So when you're at the back, it's the low note. When you're at the front, it's the high note. Although you can, there's ways around it.
So you've researched the history of that instrument. Mm. You love the history of music, the history generally.
Yeah.
How important is that to you?
For my imagination, for my creative imagination, and even if the history isn't accurate, I'll make it up, like, don't you know the way? I think it's important. Again, the fascinating thing about the jaw harp is Gangani. I was talking to you about Gangani earlier on, is tied in, because there is a Morchang, it's called a Morchang jaw harp, which comes from the Gangani region. And of course I have six of them.
Yeah.
Like, you know, because it ties in so nicely with. So I just like the continuum of that, like, you know, that you have something, but you also have, you don't only have the information of something, but you have, you also have an instrument from that something. You know what I mean? It's again, it's the creative and it's the imagination. It's, I love it, yeah.
Lovely sound off it. You mentioned earlier that you don't read music, but you obviously have to have a very good ear for music.
Yeah. No, I can pick up music fairly fast. Yeah. This was a lot of practice now to be able to play a tune with this, because it's not easy. It's not easy to do, basically. So it takes a lot of practice. But it's for me, it's just a fascinating instrument. It's a very ancient instrument. They've found like thousands and thousands of years. The archaeologists have found this instrument. So I find it fascinating. It comes mainly from Mongolia, then you go into India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, you go down as far as Thailand, into Cambodia, so all those countries have it.
Their own version.
Ancient versions of it. And the Ukraine, that one there is from the Ukraine, for example. And of course then there are European ones, which is why it's actually called the Jew's harp. The only reason it's called the Jew's harp is because in the 17th and 18th century in Europe, it was the Jews that were making them. That's all. They just happened to be metal workers and jaw harp, Jews harp makers. So that's why it got that name. So yeah, it's a great old instrument.
Growing up, were you known as Christy Moore's nephew? Or did the surname throw people off the track?
The surname throws people off the track. Back then it would have been great. I would have enjoyed that it threw people off the track. It'd be handy for my job in this day and age.
But well, he does promote you on his Facebook page.
Fair play to him. Indeed, he does. Indeed, he does. Listen, I put it to you like this. Part of my shyness, and my mother would be the same, and other members of the family would be the same, was because you're related to Christy Moore, you're a bit intimidated by that. Do you know what I mean? As a singer, like, how are you going to measure up? Mammy used to be a very shy singer anyway, but her shyness was compounded by the fact that she was known as Christy Moore's sister. You know, she'd probably kill me now for saying this, but anyway, I've said it now. But yeah, it creates a bit of a complex within, like, do you know what I mean? Or a hesitancy to go for it, which you get to a certain age and you don't care about that kind of thing anymore. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But when you're a young fella, an impressionable and a bit not sure of yourself or a bit lacking in confidence, it did. And going away from Ireland took me away from that, didn't it?
And another uncle of yours, Barry Moore, Luke of Rome, in Australia at the moment.
Yes.
He's near the end of his
near
tour.
Near the end of his tour, fair
and
play to him, yeah.
Your grandmother,
yeah.
Grandmother Moore, was a great singer, I believe.
She was. Nana was a fantastic singer. Gosh, sure, listen. Nana was the centre of it all, to be honest with you. Nana was the centre of it all, and all the way back to Christy, like, you know, she would have been a great encourager of all of her children and grandchildren in playing their music. She was a wonderful opera singer herself, amateur opera singer. She was a great piano player. She would have come from a semi-classical background, like, you know, she would have been able to read music, which I can't. But Nana would have been just so encouraging in everything that any of her children or grandchildren did, which made me an encouraging father, really, to be honest with you, because I realised how it's very important to encourage your children in their endeavours, be it music or not. And Nana was always she was always there for each and every one of us and encouraging. And she'd write, you know, she'd hear you sing a song, because I used to write poetry when I was a teenager, and I found recently only two or three letters that she wrote back to me in reference to the poetry that I was writing, and she was loved this poem, this is beautiful poetry. And I know from talking to Christy that she used to do the same with him when he was on tour in England back in the 60s. She'd write, heard you did a great concert there, and you know, it's just Nana. She was a huge, huge part of the family.
Sounds like
she
from
really
everything
was.
I've heard down through the years, a wonderful woman indeed.
She really was.
And your own girls, are they following your path in any way in the music or the acting? Or
One of my daughters, Leanne, she definitely is following the acting path. She's part of my, as I was saying, my wife is also, I didn't mention this earlier on, she's also a costume maker. She works in the costume department in a theatre, so, and a quite a big reputable theatre in Lyon. So that gives my daughter, I suppose, a chance to participate in theatre a little bit more often. And so she's, over the years, she's been part of a theatre team in the theatre where my wife works. And I'd say now next year, well, it's kind of the equivalent of the Leaving Cert next year for both my girls. So let's get that done. And then I think she's probably interested. She's talking about going into theatre school, yeah. My other daughter, Amelia, now she'd be more of the, let's say, practical way of looking at things. And she's more interested in going into commerce and maybe into selling clothes or into the clothes market, something like that. You know, having her own little boutique is what she dreams of. So, you
they're
know,
still young yet.
They're still young. And
yeah,
sure, listen,
of course.
Time for all of that yet, yeah, you know.
Do you play music with your mum and dad?
Yeah.
Occasionally?
When I come home, we do, yeah. I play with my father more than I would with my mother. My mother and myself, we'd share songs. We wouldn't necessarily play together, kind of a thing. Each would have their own turn. We have different pitches and voices as well, so there's that. But myself and my father, I'd accompany him in the bar, and he'd play a few tunes in the whistle. We'd play a few tunes in the whistle together, yeah.
The future then, Davoog, are you on the road often? Are you performing often?
Yeah.
And recording, of course.
Recording, yeah. Just as I said, finished recording my fourth album. Yes, my fourth album. On the road a lot. Winter time is still, since COVID, quiet. COVID obviously affected everybody in the arts all over the place. So, I am on the road a lot from March until October. And then it'll quieten down a bit, and I'll go into recording mode, or I'll find other things. I recorded, we made a short mini-series of Gangani. You'll find it on YouTube, the Gangani tribe, with a few people involved in it around a fire, and it was lovely. In the middle of the beautiful region of the Beaujolais where I live, there was snow, and it was lovely. It was really lovely. It was hard work, though, because we had to go up a quite a steep hill in the middle of a snowstorm. it was tough going.
Not far from the Alps, of course.
Yeah, I'm quite near the Alps, yeah. I'm just on the bottom of the Alps, in fact. But the future, I've broken into Germany now. I've been back in Germany for the first time in 24 years. Now as a musician, as a touring musician, so I'm looking to go back there again this year. I've got something going on there in August, in the making. Back to Ireland twice a year now because the parents are getting on, families are getting older, and I want to bring my daughters home a little bit more often. And so in order to do that, I'm creating a few gigs to pay for that, really. Coming back to Ireland is always not... It's expensive.
Of course.
So yeah. A couple of gigs and off you go, like, you know. I'm trying to break into the UK as well, although they're having their own difficulties. It's difficult touring in this day and age, especially post-COVID, is because you realise that when you go on tour, that you're actually stepping into somebody else's territory, other musicians, other artists. So what I really try to do and make a real attempt to do is that when I do go to other countries like Belgium and Holland are big markets for me, I go there very often. So when I do go to Belgium and Holland, I make sure I have a local musician that will support me so that at least there's balance, you know. And even when I come home, like, you know, I come back to Ireland and I try to get a local musician, like I did last night. I did in Kilrush. I had Astrid Adler playing the harp. I'm up in Dublin now, and I've got the Traveller singer Trish Riley. She's supporting me. So yeah, it's the way it used to be back in the 70s and the 80s. You'd have musicians supporting each other. Unfortunately, this day and age, it's a little bit less. But sure, listen, it is what it is. I like to keep these traditions going anyway.